Assalamu alaikum students. On behalf of the Ministry of Science and Technology, Virtual University of Pakistan and Mubashir Humayun, I welcome you to another lecture of Financial Management. In this lecture, we will continue our discussion of financial leverage and capital structure. Now, before I begin the new contents for this lecture, let me go over some of the concepts and formulas that we talked about in the previous lectures. We began by talking about the weighted average cost of capital. And we mentioned that companies or firms need to calculate this figure in order to find out what the minimum required rate of return they should expect from their investments in new projects and securities. The formula for calculating the weighted average cost of capital is very simple. The WACC, or WACC, is a percentage term, and it is equal to RDXD plus REXE plus RPXP. Now, D over here stands for debt, P stands for preferred stock, and E stands for common equity. The R term in this formula refers to the cost of that particular kind of capital. And the R can be calculated from the required rate of return after making adjustments for taxes and transaction costs. Just to refresh your memory, we calculate the required rate of return for a bond using the bond pricing equation, present value, and solving it by trial and error for the R value. And we did this when we calculated the yield to maturity of YTM for the bond. That's the case for debt. Now, when you're talking about the required rate of return for equity, we use the Gordon's formula for common equity in order to calculate the required rate of return. Also, please remember that when you are calculating the cost of equity capital, of a common equity, then there are two possible approaches. And you can use the Gordon's formula, which is the dividends approach, to calculate the required rate of return, or you can use the capital asset pricing model's security market line equation, which uses beta and risk premium. Also, please keep in mind that there are two ways to generate new equity. You can either use the retained earnings, which are the savings that the company has accumulated over its life in the form of net income that has been collected in the history of the company, or you can issue new stock or new common equity. Naturally, if a company does not have enough retained earnings, then it has to issue new stock. The disadvantage with issuing new stock is that it is time-consuming and it is costly because it has transaction costs that are paid to brokers and lawyers and investment bankers that are associated with it. We then spoke about business risk, and we said that when we were talking about risk in portfolio theory for stocks, then for standalone investments in a single stock, the risk of a stock is equal to the diversifiable risk plus the market risk. We'd made this division because we were interested in calculating the beta or the market risk for a stock. Now our attention has shifted to firms and companies. And the standalone risk for a firm is equal to the business risk plus the financial risk. We make these divisions because for firms, we're interested in the capital structure, and we need to make a distinction between debt and equity. So, when we talk about financial risk, we are talking about risk that is entirely associated with debt. We mentioned that for firms or companies, when we talk about risk, we are talking about the standard deviation or the spread or the range of possible values in the return on equity. The return on equity, or ROE, is representative of the overall return of a company. Just like the required rate of return was representative of the return on a security like a stock or a bond. We used the Gordon's formula to calculate the required rate of return for a stock, and we used the ROE or return on equity to calculate the overall rate of return for a firm. Now, we mentioned that the total standalone risk for a firm is equal to the business risk plus the financial risk. Well, in terms of the standard deviation and ROE, the total standalone risk for a firm that has both debt and equity in its capital structure is equal to the standard deviation of the ROE for the levered firm. And by levered, it means that the firm has debt as well as equity. The business risk can be defined in terms of the standard deviation of the ROE for the unlevered firm. The unlevered firm is the firm which has 100% equity and no debt. Just to refresh your memory, business risk is risk that is caused by the assets or operations of the business itself. And there is both a specific aspect to this risk as well as a market-related aspect. We mentioned that the business risk has many causes, including variations and fluctuations in prices and costs. And the major factor that we focused on was operating leverage. We said that the higher the operating leverage of a firm, the higher its business risk. Now, operating leverage is defined as the fixed costs divided by the total costs. We mentioned that leverage, the concept of leverage, means magnification. It amplifies or enlarges the effect. And for the case of operating leverage, what we are saying is that a small change in the sales of a company can lead to a very, very large change in the operating profit or loss, and a very, very large change in the return on equity or ROE. We talked about the operating leverage concept by looking at a graph, and we said that when a firm has higher operating leverage, then there is a greater risk that it will have a large drop or a fall in the return on equity if there is a small drop in the sales. We also mentioned that the firms with higher operating leverage have higher break-even points, which means that they need to produce and sell a higher amount or quantity of goods in order to cover their total costs. The point to remember regarding operating leverage is that when a firm is operating at a quantity of sales and production which is higher than the break-even point, then operating leverage is good. In other words, in that case, if the firm is producing more units than the break-even point, then a small increase in the sales will lead to a very, very large increase in the ROE. So operating leverage is beneficial. But if the firm is operating below the break-even point, then a small decrease in the sales will lead to a much larger decrease in the ROE. And that is a source of risk. So operating leverage increases the expected ROE, but it also increases the overall risk. And we saw that in the form of the probability distribution curves. You will recall that firms with higher operating leverage have shorter and flatter probability distribution curves. We then moved on to the concept of financial risk. And we can calculate the financial risk, which is equal to the total standalone risk for the firm minus the business risk. So, for example, if we know that the total standalone risk as measured by the standard deviation of the ROE of the levered firm, if that is equal to 30%, and if we know that the business risk or the standard deviation of the unlevered firm, which is 100% equity, if that is equal to 20%, then we know that the financial risk is equal to 30% minus 20%, which is equal to 10%. We said that the causes of financial risk are debt. When a firm takes on loans, an excessive amount of borrowing, then it is more prone to financial risk. And this is where we introduce the concept of financial leverage. Again, leverage over here is magnifying an effect. And what effect is that? A small change in the EBIT or the earnings before interest and taxation can lead to a very, very large effect or change in the ROE or the return on equity of the firm. So the financial leverage then can be defined in terms of the percent of the total capital that is debt. In other words, the financial leverage or FL is equal to the debt divided by the total assets. You will recall from financial accounting the total assets is equal to debt plus equity. So the financial leverage is equal to debt divided by debt plus equity, which is equal to D divided by D plus E. For example then, if a company has total assets of 1,000 rupees and a total debt of 500 rupees, then the financial leverage is equal to 500 divided by 1,000, which is equal to 50%. So we would say that the firm is 50% leveraged. It means that it has 50% debt and 50% equity. Now, practically speaking, when a firm needs to embark on financial leverage, in other words, when a firm decides that it needs to increase the level of debt in its capital structure, then it has two options. The first option is the firm simply goes out and takes a loan or a lease, or it issues a bond, and therefore it increases the total debt in its capital structure. The other option that the firm has is to simultaneously reduce the amount of equity and replace it with the same amount of debt. This is the case of replacement, where the firm buys back the shares that it had issued from the public, and in return it buys, or rather it issues, the equivalent amount of debt. So supposing that it has 1,000 rupees of equity in the market, the firm might decide to buy back 500 rupees worth of equity and to replace it with 500 rupees worth of a loan. Next, let's take a look at what the impact of financial leverage on the risk and the return of a firm is. The impact of financial leverage is to increase the mean or the expected rate of return as measured by the ROE or the return on equity, and also to increase the overall risk of the firm. Now, let us take a look at a table which will show to you how, when a firm becomes levered or when a firm takes on more debt, that it increases the variability or the range of possible outcomes for the return on equity or ROE, and how it also increases the average or the mean ROE. If you take a look at the slide, you will see the table for financial leverage, which shows the effect of leverage on ROE volatility and risk. If you look at the columns, then you will note the similarity to the income statement or profit and loss statement. And if you look at the table horizontally, you will see that I've divided it up into the case of the unlevered firm, which has no debt, in other words 100% equity, and the other case below it is a case of the same firm with loans or with debt, and that is the case of the levered firm. So we will use the formula for calculating ROE and net income, which we used in the financial accounting profit and loss statement. EBIT, or earnings before interest and taxation, minus interest is equal to the earnings before tax, or EBT, and EBT minus tax is equal to the net income, or NI, and then finally, the net income divided by the equity is equal to the ROE. Now, I have shown what happens to the ROE of this firm as you change the earnings from 50 rupees to 600 rupees. This variation in the earnings can be caused by random events or market forces, and this change in sales revenue can lead to a change in the EBIT, and that is the source of risk. And this leads to a change in the possible values for ROE. Now let's take a look at the impact of a change in the EBIT from 50 to 600 rupees on the value of the ROE for the unlevered firm. You will note that for the unlevered firm, the ROE goes from 3.5% to 42%. However, take a look at the levered firm. When the firm, same firm, takes on debt, the same change in EBIT will cause a much larger change in the ROE. The ROE, in the case of the firm which has taken on debt, goes from 0% to 77%. In other words, leverage or debt increases the spread or the range of possible ROE, thereby increasing the uncertainty and the risk. And you will also note that the expected or the mean ROE is higher for the levered firm, that is 35%, than it is for the unlevered firm, which is only 21%. So what we are saying is that financial leverage increases the average return on equity, but it also increases the total risk of the firm. Now, why does the financial leverage increase the expected or the average return on equity? This can be understood in a couple of ways, and one of them is that there are two ways to look at an increase in the level of debt or the percentage of debt in the capital structure. One way is that a firm can reduce its equity. By reducing its equity, automatically the firm will increase its percentage of debt in the overall capital structure. Now, in this case, the firm, if we assume, is making the same amount of money or it has the same earnings as before, but now those same earnings are distributed across fewer number of shares, therefore the return per share will increase, and therefore the average return on equity will also increase. The other point to remember is that if the ratio of the EBIT to the total assets in the firm is greater than the cost of interest that it pays to the bank or to the bondholder, in that case, financial leverage will be beneficial and good, because if the overall rate of return for the firm as measured by the EBIT divided by total assets is higher than its cost of debt, then it is generating profit from debt, and therefore debt will cause an increase in the ROE. We can visualize these two effects by looking at the graph of financial leverage on a plot that shows EBIT versus ROE. So let us take a look at that slide. If you visualize the effect of financial leverage on the ROE versus EBIT graph, you can see the impact that it has on ROE and on the capital structure. We are looking at the same example that I had tabulated with the numbers earlier on. If you take a look at the case of the unlevered or 100% equity firm, you will see that it is represented by the line with the shallower slope. The range of possible ROE values for the unlevered firm goes from 3.5% to 42%. Now, if you take a look at the same firm, but the case where it has taken on debt, in other words, the same firm levered, then you will see that the line is represented by a higher slope, and you will note that the ROE has become more sensitive to the changes in EBIT. What do I mean by this? It means that for the same change in the EBIT, going from 50 to 600 rupees, notice how when a firm takes on debt, the range of possible ROE, as seen on the y-axis, expands. So for the case of the levered firm, the ROE range is from 0% to 77%. And if you look at the y-axis, I have shown the likely probability distributions for both cases. Note how the distribution for the unlevered or 100% equity firm is narrow and tall, whereas the probability distribution for the levered firm with debt is shorter and flatter and wider. So what this is saying is that not only does financial leverage increase the expected return on equity, but it also increases the overall level of risk. Now, by risk, we are using the measure of standard deviation in the ROE. And just as we did in the case of operating leverage, we can visualize the effect of financial leverage on the probability distribution for each of the two cases, the levered case and the unlevered case or 100% equity case. So let us take a look at the slide to help us visually recognize what happens to the risk and return as a company increases its level of debt. If you visualize the impact of financial leverage on the ROE and the capital structure, you can also take a look at the probability distribution curves. Here I have graphed the probability of an outcome leading to a particular value of ROE, which I had shown in the table a little earlier. And we have graphed that against the return on equity, or ROE, as measured in percentage terms. Take a look at the two probability distributions. You will note that the sharper and taller probability distribution represents the unlevered or 100% equity firm, and this kind of firm has a relatively low return on equity, and that mean ROE or average ROE for the unlevered firm is equal to 21%. But when the same firm increases its level of debt, in other words, when it increases its leverage, take a look at what happens to the probability distribution for the levered firm. It has a higher mean or average ROE, and that is shown by the shorter, flatter probability distribution curve, which has a peak to the right-hand side of the other distribution. Note also that this case of a firm with higher debt not only has a higher average ROE, but it also has higher overall risk. And you can visualize the risk by looking at the width or the spread of this probability distribution curve. Please note that for the levered case, the probability distribution of ROE is shorter and flatter, and thereby indicating that it is also riskier. Now, I've just mentioned that financial leverage increases both the expected or average ROE, but it also increases the overall risk of the firm. Specifically speaking, if the overall return of a firm as measured by EBIT divided by total assets is higher than its cost of debt measured in the form of interest, then financial leverage can be good or beneficial. Why? Because in that case, a small increase in the earnings before interest and taxation or EBIT can lead to a much larger increase in the return on equity for the shareholders. So financial leverage can be beneficial if the firm's earnings and cash flows are healthy. However, if the overall return of the firm is less than the interest costs, then financial leverage can be very, very risky and costly. Now, if financial leverage generally increases the level of risk and the level of return, then how do we know if financial leverage is good or not? You will remember that we spoke about the fundamental principle of risk and return quite a few lectures back when we were talking about portfolio theory. And that principle was that the investors, rational investors in efficient markets, will not take on any extra risk unless they're getting additional return. So how do we know if financial leverage is giving enough additional return to compensate for the extra risk? How do we know if financial leverage is good or not? And the answer to this is not an easy one, and it is presented by the capital structure theory. The theory of capital structure was formally introduced to us by two very famous professors in the United States by the name of Professors Modigliani and Professor Miller. These two professors wrote what is considered to be the most revolutionary and perhaps the most important article in finance ever written. The name of the article was Cost of Capital, Corporate Finance, and the Theory of Investment. And it was written in June of 1958 in the American Economic Review. Other than perhaps the article written by William Sharp and Markowitz regarding the capital asset pricing model and theory, this is one of the most seminal articles in finance. Professor Modigliani and Miller went on to win the Nobel Prize for their theory on capital structure. Capital structure theory tries to answer the question about what percentage or what amount of debt is ideal or best for a company to maintain. Broadly speaking, there is no fixed ratio of debt that is considered to be good. The percentage of debt in the capital structure varies in the life of the company depending on its needs and its strategy. But Miller and Modigliani came up with an ideal or idealized model. They assumed an efficient market where there are no taxes and no transaction costs, where there is no bankruptcy cost, and where every investor and manager and owner in the market has the same access to information. Now, these are big assumptions, and this is not exactly true in the real world. So the conclusions of Miller and Modigliani are not entirely accurate, but they give us very, very important insight into the impact of debt and capital structure on the value of a firm and investment decisions. The conclusion that Miller and Modigliani, known as MM for short, came up with was as follows. It was a revolutionary statement. They said that capital structure or the amount of debt in a firm has absolutely no bearing on the value of that firm. In other words, what they said was that it doesn't matter whether a company has taken on 10% debt in its capital structure or 90% debt in its capital structure. The percentage of debt and the amount of debt that it has taken has absolutely no effect on the value of the firm, and it has no effect on capital budgeting and investment decisions that it makes. Now, under these ideal conditions, their conclusion is correct. And this is why, in this course, right at the beginning of this course, we studied capital budgeting and investment decisions. And we did not at all worry about whether the firm or company is levered or leveraged, or whether it has 100% equity or 50% equity. The capital budgeting decisions and investment decisions that a firm makes are entirely independent of its capital structure. That was the assumption that we are going by. What this means is that the ratio of debt to equity in a company or firm has no bearing on the value of the firm as calculated using the NPV formula. Now, this is only true under the ideal conditions and assumptions that Miller and Modigliani made. Naturally, that was the ideal situation, and in order to apply this theory practically to the real world, there were other economists and gurus of financial management that changed the theory and applied it to the real world situation. So let us take a look at how this theory was changed in order to make it applicable and relevant for practical use in the real world. The first modification or change that was made to the Miller-Modigliani or MM theory was to include the effect of taxes. The theory was adapted and changed in order to account for the impact of corporate taxes and personal taxes on the investment decision and on the firm. This adaptation and modification was done by Miller and Modigliani themselves. And the conclusion that they came up with was that, generally speaking, in most countries around the world, the corporate tax, or the tax that companies have to pay to the government, favors the raising of capital in the form of debt. Why? Because you will recall that the interest that a company pays on debt is tax deductible. In other words, it is not taxed. Therefore, the interest represents a tax saving or a tax shield or a tax shelter. Whereas the equity and the dividends paid on the equity do not lead to any tax savings as far as corporate tax goes. So from the company's point of view or the firm's point of view, there is a saving associated with capital that is raised in the form of debt or loan. So firms based on corporate taxation would prefer to issue debt rather than equity. However, they also pointed out that if you take the case or the point of view of the investor, the person who is giving his money to the firms in the form of debt or equity, from the investor's point of view, this investor has to pay personal tax or individual tax. And now the situation is reversed. In most countries around the world, individual investors pay more personal tax on income from debt in the form of interest than they do on income in the form of capital gains from equity or in the form of dividend income from equity. So from the investor's point of view, they would prefer to give their money and to invest their money in equity. Now there's a difference between what form of capital is better depending on whether you are looking at the firm and corporate taxes or whether you're looking at the individual investor and his personal taxes. The net result of this opposing effect that you see is that when you take both effects of corporate tax and personal tax into consideration, the net effect is, generally speaking, it is better for a firm to issue debt in terms of taxes, because the tax savings from interest payments are more important than the tax savings for the investors from the income from equity. But let me stop right here, the new contents for this particular lecture. We will continue our discussion of the Miller-Modigliani theory and the changes and modifications that were made to this theory to make it practically relevant in the following lecture. Let us go over some of the concepts and formulas that we learned in this particular lecture. I began talking about the weighted average cost of capital, which is basically used by firms to set a minimum required rate of return for their investments in projects and securities. We mentioned that the weighted average cost of capital is based on the slightly modified required rate of return. It is adjusted by the effect of taxes and transaction costs. We mentioned that equity capital can be raised either through retained earnings of a company or through the issuance of fresh common stock. We mentioned that the total standalone risk of a firm is equal to the business risk plus the financial risk. And we had talked about business risk and operating leverage in the previous lecture. And in this lecture, we focused our attention on financial risk, which is created when a firm borrows money or takes debt. We mentioned that the financial risk can be seen in terms of the standard deviation of the ROE, or the return on equity. The return on equity is simply equal to the net income divided by the equity. And we mentioned that the major source for financial risk is financial leverage. And financial leverage is defined as the ratio of the debt to the total assets. And as you know, the total assets is equal to total liabilities, which is equal to debt plus equity. Therefore, the financial leverage is defined as the ratio of debt to debt plus equity, which is equal to D divided by D plus E. And it is basically a percent of the total capital structure that is comprised of debt. We mentioned that financial leverage, like all leverages, has a magnifying effect. It acts like a magnifying glass. And what happens is that financial leverage multiplies or enlarges the effect of small changes in the earnings or EBIT into large changes in the return on equity for the shareholders. We are focusing our attention on shareholders because our objective in financial management is maximization of shareholder wealth. And the shares or common equity that shareholders own needs to generate the highest possible return on equity. We mentioned that the financial leverage, just like operating leverage, can be good and it can also be bad. When is financial leverage good? Generally speaking, when the overall return generated by a firm, as measured by the EBIT divided by total assets, is higher than its cost of debt, as measured by the interest rate, then financial leverage is generally beneficial. Why? Because if this is the case, then a small increase in the EBIT or earnings of a firm can lead to a much larger increase in the return on equity for the shareholders. However, if the firm is unhealthy, and if its overall return or EBIT divided by total assets is less than its cost of debt or interest, then financial leverage can be quite dangerous and costly and risky. We mentioned that, generally speaking, the effect of financial leverage is to increase the average ROE and also to increase the overall risk of a firm. And we can measure the risk of a firm by statistically computing the standard deviation of the possible future ROEs. We then went on and asked ourselves that if you apply the fundamental principle of risk and return, then according to that principle, we have to remember that rational investors in efficient markets will not take on any additional risk unless they are compensated by additional return. So if financial leverage or if a firm increasing its level of borrowing increases the return on equity for the shareholders and it also increases the overall risk of the firm, then is financial leverage generally good or not? Why? Because both risk and return are going up. So is that good or bad? And the answer to that question is provided by capital structure theory. And I mentioned that the official fathers of capital structure theory are professors Miller and Modigliani, who won the Nobel Prize for their achievement. Miller and Modigliani came up with an ideal model, a market where there are no taxes, no bankruptcy costs associated with companies going out of business, and where every investor and shareholder and manager in a company has the same level of information or knowledge. In such a situation, they came up with a revolutionary conclusion, and that conclusion was that capital structure or the amount of debt that a company has no effect on the value of that company. They're not linked. And they said that, therefore, the capital structure or the amount of debt has no bearing on the value of a company as calculated using our old formula of NPV that we did in the beginning of this course. And this is an important result. It is important because it tells us that we can separate capital budgeting and investment decisions from corporate financing and capital structure decisions. This is why you generally find that in financial management, you study capital budgeting and investment decisions very early on, without worrying about what the capital structure or the level of debt and equity in a firm is. You can worry about that later. However, Miller and Modigliani presented an ideal situation, and practically speaking, in the real world, we come across taxes, we come across companies going out of business and going bankrupt, and we also come across differences in the amount of knowledge and information that shareholders have. Oftentimes, managers and owners of a particular company have more information about that company than the average outside or common shareholder. And so, others have presented changes or modifications in Miller and Modigliani's theory to account for these differences. And then we find that there is such a thing as an optimal or best capital structure that we can estimate. And we will talk about this more in detail in the following lecture. So with this, I would like to conclude this particular lecture on financial leverage, introduction to Miller and Modigliani theory for capital structure. I would urge you, please, to carefully read chapter 13 in the 8th edition of Brigham and Kapinski, Financial Management Theory and Practice. In Chapter 13, you will find a detailed presentation of the same concepts that we have been talking about, and that should adequately be able to explain to you the concepts of leverage and of capital structure theory. With this, I close the lecture. I thank you for your kind attention and patience. On behalf of the Ministry of Science and Technology, Virtual University of Pakistan, and Mubashir Humayun, I thank you. Khuda Hafiz and Assalamu Alaikum.